Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have come to admire greatly the intelligence as well as the commitment to public service of our first guest. He is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He has been for many years involved with intelligence analysis and policy application. In successive roles in the United States Congress, he was also before that an analyst with the Central Intelligence Agency. Dr. Pry has been perhaps best known, however, for his long and dedicated service to a commission the Congress established to provide a second opinion, a detailed understanding of the threat arising to our nation from electromagnetic pulse. This EMP threat commission is now, I am devastated to report, about to expire, and with it the end of some 17 years of warnings and profoundly important recommendations about the threat we're facing to our electric grid, most especially. We're delighted to have Dr. Pry with us to talk a bit about the nature of this EMP threat and what must be done about it at this moment. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, thank you so much for joining us again. It's good to talk with you.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
So very quickly, Peter, just a 101 introduction to our audience, though I think most of them are pretty familiar with this phenomenon. But what is electromagnetic pulse? How could it be inflicted upon this country, and with what effects?
Yeah, an EMP can be caused by nature, by a solar storm from the sun, you know, which could generate an EMP, which is akin to a super energetic radio wave with enough energy in it to destroy electronics within the EMP field. In the case of a geomagnetic superstorm like the 1859 Carrington event, it would affect the whole world and cause the collapse of electric grids and electronics everywhere in the world. In the case of a nuclear weapon from terrorists or a rogue state like North Korea that has just recently tested a hydrogen bomb that they describe as a dial-a-yield type weapon that has a setting for super EMP, you know, you could affect all of North America with a single such weapon that was the collapse of the electric grid, which is our biggest concern. And, you know, because if we had a blackout which lasted a year or even months, you could lose millions of Americans. The EMP Commission has estimated up to 9 of 10 Americans to die in a nationwide blackout that lasted 1 year, starvation and societal collapse.
It's just unimaginably awful. But Peter Pry, when you look at what has been warned about by the commission for these 17 or so years, what has been the response of the federal government and the electric utilities to these warnings? Have your recommendations as a commission been adopted? And if so, are we now better equipped to contend with these sorts of threat?
There's a real dichotomy here, Frank. You know, the Department of Defense takes the EMP threat seriously. Even the Obama administration spent nearly $1 billion further hardening NORAD headquarters at Cheyenne Mountain and other command and control links against the possibility of a nuclear EMP threat from North Korea. But when it comes to the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Energy, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, those organizations responsible for protecting the electric grid and our civilian critical infrastructures, they act as if EMP is merely a theoretical threat, that it isn't proven, that we need to do more studies on it to see whether it's a threat, as if all that data, over 50 years of experience, testing, and from the Department of Defense doesn't exist. In part, the DOD is to be blamed for this because Dr. Graham, the chairman of the commission, has criticized them as recently as yesterday for sitting on and keeping classified a lot of the data on EMP. But there should be no excuse to apply a little common sense from the Department of Homeland Security, NERC, and FERC, and all these other guys because they can know just from newspaper reports that the Department of Defense does harden systems against EMP. They know it's a real threat. We wouldn't be spending billions of dollars on EMP protection of our military system if it wasn't a real threat.
And Peter, you've mentioned that particularly there is a present danger from North Korea. You and oftentimes your colleague and my friend Jim Woolsey have been writing about the capabilities that the North Koreans may have, not just to lob a nuclear weapon over our country via a ballistic missile, but perhaps to use satellites, two of which they have orbiting the Earth as we speak, to unleash this kind of electromagnetic devastation on our country. Talk quickly about the danger that you and the commission have been particularly seized with from that country.
Yeah, we're very concerned, more concerned with the satellite threat than we are with North Korea's possession of intercontinental ballistic missiles. You know, the satellites are currently in orbit. They've got two of them, the KMS-2 and KMS-3, that are orbiting on an optimum trajectory to evade our national missile defenses coming up from the south and put an EMP field over North America if they were nuclear armed. We don't know if they're nuclear armed or not, but it's strange that they're on that particular trajectory, a trajectory the Soviet Union had planned during the Cold War to make a surprise nuclear EMP attack, and at the right altitude for doing that and the right trajectory for doing that. And we know the North Koreans know about EMP. They incorporated it in their war plans. It's really the only way for them to possibly win a war with the United States doing an EMP attack, because if they were to blast a city or something like that, we would turn them into a plate of glass. But EMP, we might not even know they did it if they did it by satellite, you know, because one of the first things it does is it takes out the radars and our other national technical means for ascertaining, well, where did that blast come from? Who attacked us?
Including satellites.
Yeah, and there's hundreds of satellites in low Earth orbit, you know.
Peter Pry, let me just ask you specifically on this question of what the commission has learned about collaboration between the old Soviet Union's weaponeers and those that are now building the kinds of threats you've talked about in North Korea. This is, as they say in the old Soviet Union, no accident, comrade. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. In 2004, the commission was demarched by two Russian generals and EMP experts, a couple of their top EMP experts, to warn us. Supposedly, the visit was for the purpose of a friendly warning that the design information for a super EMP nuclear weapon had accidentally leaked from Russia to North Korea, and that there were Russian scientists working on the North Korean nuclear and missile program. But it wasn't because the Russian government wanted them to. It was because it was brain drain, because the economy was bad and they had to find work somewhere.
Another accident. Yeah, it seems unlikely. Peter, against this backdrop, where there is clearly a great and growing danger to our country from a threat that you and your colleagues, led by Dr. William Graham, have been warning of for almost two decades, the commission is being dismantled. This is simply unimaginable to me. There's talk about having a new one created that will be like all of the other politically developed commissions to presumably come up with political judgments rather than technical ones. I have been championing, as I think you have, the idea of having President Trump create this commission as a presidential commission. Talk very quickly, if you would, about the need for doing that.
I think it's a vital need for there to be an executive level, something in the White House close to the president, because the problem is so big, it cuts across all of the critical infrastructures, including the military, and there's no single department or agency that can manage it. It's an executive level White House kind of a job. And indeed, President Reagan understood that, because he had originally set up in the White House something called the National Communications System, which was to harden, you know, across all government communications for federal and executive levels. This would basically be the same thing, bring back what Ronald Reagan had originally envisioned, and which, by the way, was canceled by President Obama by executive order.
Surprise, surprise, part of the wrecking operation. Peter Pry, I just want to say personally, and I think on behalf of certainly our audience and many, many others besides, thank you. to you and to your colleagues on the EMP Threat Commission for your service. I hope it will continue, but I want you to know that your leadership, your clarity about this threat, and all that you have striven to do to enable us to defend ourselves against it is of the utmost importance. I hope you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us to talk about it more in the near future. Next up, Peter Husey joins us. We'll talk about regime change in North Korea, whether that may be the answer, in part, to the threat we're now facing from that quarter. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to have with us Peter Husey, a man of extraordinary situational awareness, shall we say, about a number of things involving our national security, particularly with respect to the threats we're facing from foreign adversaries in the nuclear domain, notably, but not exclusively, North Korea. He is the president of Geostrategic Analysis. He has been working in this battle space in various capacities for many years, is the host of some of the most important breakfasts, lunches, and dinners in Washington, where people come together to study and discuss and share insights into the sorts of challenges we're facing at the nuclear level, our missile defense needs, and much more. It's always great to have a chance to talk with him, particularly because Peter has spent a considerable amount of time in Korea and particularly is knowledgeable about the threat emanating therefrom. We were talking a little bit about it a moment ago with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and I'm delighted to catch up with you, Peter. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us.
Oh, Frank, thanks very much for having me on your show. It's wonderful.
Let me ask you, Peter, first and foremost, about something that you have been mulling and recommending, really, and that seems to be, at the end of the day, probably the only solution to the problem that we're now confronting from Pyongyang, and that is regime change. It's gotten sort of a bad name because of some difficulties we've had in doing it elsewhere, but talk a little bit about why, in your judgment, and interestingly enough, that of the Wall Street Journal, among others, it's a view I share as well, that's a needed outcome here.
Well, Frank, thank you. What you're talking about is, it's interesting, is we changed the regime in Iraq and Afghanistan fairly quickly, within a matter of months. And if you look at all of Eastern Europe, the regime's changed because of the end of the Cold War, which was due to the extraordinary work of Ronald Reagan and in part Europe. Role as an official of the Department of Defense. So I look at it a little bit differently, that the end of the Cold War was the most successful set of regime changes we've ever had. The problem is the bad guys also are in that business. And if you know, during detente and peaceful coexistence, we had something of 18 countries flipped from, they weren't nice countries, but they were ended up being communist.
They became a lot worse. And you're right, Peter. It's been applied by both the good guys, as we should say, and the bad guys. How about North Korea? Are there lessons from the Cold War and the Reagan strategy for bringing down the old Soviet Union and its empire that might apply in how we might do it in Pyongyang?
You can look at something like Solidarity in Poland. You can look at this Sandinistas and the Democratic Resistance. Now that we call them the Contras. You can talk about the regime change wasn't in El Salvador. We preserved the regime, the country's government, and God bless them. They actually moved towards a democracy and got rid of the FMLN, separate in terms of the civil war. But I would look at North Korea as follows. China created Frankenstein, and he got out of a lab. And now he's running around, careening around, and causing a great deal of trouble. And the Chinese have not decided, there's not a majority in the Politburo to get rid of him, and there's not a majority to keep him. They're kind of trying to play both sides of the street, and they don't know how to come in off the window ledge. So the question is, what could we do to promote internal regime change? The key to that regime is Kim gives all his buddies huge amounts of money, good villas, Mercedes-Benz. And the question is, why not try to do everything cutting off the money? We know how the money gets there. It comes there from, there are 15 key Chinese banks and one big holding bank that has funded the missile and nuclear weapons program. I know that from testimony that was before the Senate Armed Services Committee and
hope and testimony, unclassified. And the Chinese may help us, may not, Frank. As you know, I think Bob Joseph, Ambassador Joseph, and the Wall Street Journal are right. I think John Bolton's right that what we ought to try to do is just cut off their money. If that means cutting off their oil, well, that's what the U.S. Navy could do. We could basically bring the benefits and the goodies that Kim sends to all his friends, get rid of them. And that means also they can't go into the embassies around the world and go and sell date rape drugs and heroin, which is a huge cash cow for them. And then they, all the workers that work in places like Qatar and the Middle East, you send them home. And then all that hard currency begins to dry up.
One other cash crop, of course, Peter Husey, as you know so well, from North Korea are weapons and missiles and what can go aboard them. Peter Husey, do you see any sign that as a result of President Trump's recent efforts to cut back on Chinese banks financing the regime, just as you say, that the Chinese are beginning to shift ground?
Yes, I think that there is a sense that they have moved more in the direction of getting serious about this than they have ever had. But on the other hand, they are also major supporters of North Korea economically, trade, oil, and food. So as I said, they're of two minds. And the Chinese, as you know, try to play both sides of the street at the same time. And there are those who have concluded that in the final analysis, they're not going to go where we want them to go. But at least this president and this administration, God love them, have decided to test that and say, we're going to push as hard as we can on China to see that they have to make a decision. The narrative that's in the media is that it's not China's fault. They never talk about China's complicity in building the nuclear weapons and missiles with their money and technology. A couple of Chinese industries have been indicted, as you know, one in 2009 and then one just recently. So we've let China off the hook, and China loves that because they say, oh, it's your problem. You go talk to the guy. And then the question is, everybody says, we'll talk. And they never say, we'll talk about what. And then everybody says, well, the poor North Koreans feel in our hostile policy. And you ask them, what does that mean? And it says, well, we have forces in Guam and South Korea, and our nuclear umbrellas over South Korea. So we got rid of all those three things. The North Koreans would be happy.
Peter, let me ask you, one other piece of the Reagan strategy, as you know so well, was to discredit the enemy that is posing this threat, to delegitimate it, to undermine its standing at home. We had a terrific conversation with Suzanne Schulte, who I think you know from the Defense Forum Foundation, the other day. She's been working intensively with defectors and people who are getting information inside North Korea. You spent a lot of time in the south of the peninsula yourself. I think you probably have as good a reading as to what are the potentials there for effecting an alienation from this dynastic nightmare among the other political leaders, the military, what have you, in that regime. Is that a possibility? And if so, what more should we be doing?
Ironically, last night I was over at the Korean embassy where they had a celebration of their Armed Forces Day, and Mr. An, the ambassador, this is his last day of 5 years serving his country. Extraordinary, interesting man that I've had a chance to talk to, and they have introduced me to a number of defectors from North Korea. The single thing that the Kim regime absolutely hates is the literature and information and that's going into North Korea that tells the truth about what the regime is about. And it is the one area where we have not been very aggressive, but I think this administration and the current South Korean government are moving in the right direction, is take down the legitimacy of the regime was one of the key things we did throughout Eastern Europe, and why Reagan called the Soviet Empire an evil empire, and why Mr. Trump said at the UN, socialism is not the solution in Venezuela, it's the problem.
It's the problem everywhere it's been practiced, yeah. And in fact, the more faithfully it's practiced, the bigger the problem, I think, was his point. Peter, we have to leave it at that, but this is really such an important insight, and I appreciate you sharing it with us. I hope, indeed, that the government of South Korea, which is seemingly of the view that they need to try to appease and romance the North, is on board with this idea of delegitimating it, because I think that will be critical to bringing it down.
I think the part where you and I would emphasize, the Trump administration would emphasize, they are favorable to that, but at the same time, they have to say, well, we need to also dialogue.
Yeah. That seems like it's simply incoherence, not just two minds. Peter, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you, my friend. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Bill Gertz joins us next, as promised. China and its nuclear role in North Korea. That more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back for our weekly visit inside the ring with one of the most extraordinary national security reporters of, well, not only our time, but all time. He is Bill Gertz, the prize-winning columnist of the Inside the Ring column at the Washington Times, also the senior editor at an indispensable online resource, the Washington Free Beacon, the author of 7 terrific and best-selling books, including most recently iWar, Inside War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill Gertz, welcome back. It's good to have you, sir.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the show.
Bill, we've been talking throughout the program about the threat from North Korea. I know you have been following it very closely. I did want to just explore with you the unique and very ominous role that China has been playing in enabling that threat. One of our colleagues has recently described the North Koreans as really nothing more than the Chinese sock puppets, an appellation which has also been applied, by the way, to the Iranians and Pakistanis. Bill, you study the Chinese closely. You report on them all the time. What role is China playing in enabling the threat we're now facing from North Korea?
Well, I think the problem has been a fundamental misunderstanding of the Chinese system. This is a communist regime with a communist military that has as its main goal the preservation of the regime in Beijing. And to further that end, they've aligned themselves with states like North Korea, like Iran, that are backing that regime. And of course, this is a misunderstanding, and it's been a misunderstanding for more than 20 years by the U.S. government, which has looked at China as somehow a facilitator of solving the problem of North Korea, when it's not going to happen. The Chinese are backing the North Koreans. They have a defense alliance with them that's been underway. It's very broadly worded. Any attack on North Korea will be considered an attack on China, and their military will respond. And that has facilitated the transfer of weapons and technology. And that's where we see the North Koreans developing long-range missiles. They couldn't do that by themselves. Nuclear weapons. The Chinese facilitated Pakistan's nuclear weapons program.
Yeah, and it would appear with the Iranians as well. Bill, to what extent, if at all, does it seem that the Chinese are responding to President Trump's latest round of sanctions against their banks in a way that might portend a rift between the Chinese and the North Koreans, perhaps even to the point, as we were talking about with Peter Husey a moment ago, of bringing the Chinese along on the necessity of regime change in North Korea? Do you see any sign of that?
No. I think, again, these are window dressing on the part of the Chinese to try and make it appear as if they're cooperating. And then, of course, all the pro-China cheerleaders in the U.S. will jump on that and say, oh, isn't it great the Chinese are finally cracking down on North Korea? Until we see real sanctions imposed and basically enforced, there's going to be no change in the Chinese position. The North Koreans have been successful in using Chinese banks. They're going to continue to be successful, and the Chinese won't stop it. They claim that they don't control them. So I don't think it's going to change much. And I would also point out that nothing has been done to punish China for the most damaging strategic transfer of technology, which was the foundations for the transporter erector launchers now used on their long-range missiles and medium-range missiles. Until that happens, until we see sanctions on that company, we know the company, we know its subsidiaries, and yet nothing has been done to punish this strategic, extremely damaging strategic transfer of missile technology.
Yeah, it's so dangerous because it does, in fact, enable the North Koreans to have a potentially first strike capability against the United States with essentially undetectable mobile transporter erector launchers and their long-range missiles. Bill, let me ask you, speaking of the region and what the Chinese are doing in it to our detriment, there is something you've called, or perhaps this is a Chinese term, magic operations to promote their influence, including in some very unlikely places. I mean, allies of the United States. Talk about that.
Yeah, this is based on a report that was done and produced just this week by a New Zealand professor, Anne-Marie Brady, who exposed what she identified correctly as Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader's magic weapons, that is, influence operations that have greatly expanded under Xi. This is basically what I term in my book IWAR as information warfare operations, the use of non-military, non-kinetic warfare tools, influence operations, to basically achieve strategic objectives. And the report uses the South Pacific nation of New Zealand as a case study in this influence activities. And it shows that at least three members of the parliament are agents of China and have been doing China's bidding in what the Chinese call United Front work, which is Communist Party intelligence and influence work.
You know, this reminds me, speaking of New Zealand, of some pathbreaking work that another Kiwi, Trevor Loudon, has been doing on the extent to which the Marxist, communists, socialists, whatever you want to call them, some of them under the sway of the old Soviet Union and the successor thereto, Vladimir Putin's regime, as well as the communist Chinese, are infiltrating our government as well and subverting us from within. It's a shocking story, but one that urgently needs to be told. Bill, let me finally turn to something you've also been reporting on, and that is the problems that we're facing trying to maintain our naval presence in the Pacific region, specifically the Western Pacific and South China Sea. Your latest reporting on what happened to one of our most advanced and most needed ships, the USS John McCain, an Aegis ballistic missile defense ship, when it collided with a merchant ship a few weeks back, is chilling. Talk a little bit about what we've learned so far and what you make of it.
Yeah, the Navy has concluded that what caused that collision was not a cyber attack, although they're still looking into that potential. It was something called a steering casualty, which means that the ship lost steering control, and unfortunately, the crew was not prepared to go to manual backup. The way it works is that they have hydraulic and electric commands at the bridge, which basically turn the rudder to steer the ship, and that went out. And instead of having people manned at the aft of the ship that could literally turn it by hand, they weren't there. So it was an indication of severe readiness problems, which is the initial cause for that deadly collision, which killed a number of sailors, and being the second one in 2 months or so.
Yeah. Let me just read you something, Bill, that appeared on FoxNews.com recently. It's just, I mean, stunningly alarming. We've been talking with some of our naval experts on this, and it's a head-scratcher, I think, to some extent, as well as a terrible affirmation of the concerns that many of us have been expressing. It says that as of late June, 8 of the 11 cruisers and destroyers in the 7th Fleet, that is 8 of the 11 cruisers and destroyers in the 7th Fleet and their crew members, weren't certified by the U.S. Navy to conduct mobility seamanship or basic steering of the ship, according to Navy records, and that 7 of those ships had expired training certification in the area of cruise missile defense and surface warfare. Bill Gertz, I'm sure this isn't a surprise to you, knowing as much as you do about the condition of our forces after years of sequestration and so on, but could this be contributing to the kind of problems that you've just reported on in connection with this particular vessel?
Sure, very much so. In fact, a senior Navy official talked to me recently and said the problem is that these ships are being deployed at such high rates that they have to waive the training requirements. All ships are supposed to undergo regular training on these different areas. And what has happened is because they're being deployed so much, They've been given a break from having to conduct these kinds of training operations, and I think this is a fundamental problem there. They've got to fix that.
Diversity training seems not to be lapsing, but the seamanship is. Bill Gertz, thank you as always for the terrific work you do at the Washington Times and Washington Free Beacon. Check out his terrific new book, I War, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, come back to us again next week. Next up, Dan Gallington joins us. We'll talk about the nature and condition of the U.S. nuclear deterrent in the face of all these threats. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Daniel Gallington, a man with more titles in various capacities in the federal government than we would have time to go through, certainly to do justice to. He has worked at senior levels, and I had the privilege of collaborating with him in a previous life in the Reagan administration, but he's gone on to serve in both the Defense Department, the Justice Department, on Capitol Hill as, among other things, the General Counsel to the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. These days, he is a consultant, he is teaching, he is also writing a column for the Washington Times. It's always good to have him in the house. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. It's always a pleasure for me. Always a pleasure for me.
Dan, let me turn quickly to the North Korea drama. We've been talking about it throughout the program. It is clearly on the minds of policymakers here in the United States and elsewhere around the world as the threat seems to be becoming more grievous by the day, perhaps of an electromagnetic pulse attack, perhaps the leading edge of China's magic and other operations, as Bill Gertz has described them, against us. One of the things that we have clung to try to prevent any country, not just North Korea, perhaps in due course Iran, but China, Russia as well, from contemplating attacks against us, has been having a credible, effective nuclear deterrent. You have been involved in this business for a long time in the Air Force and in the civilian side of the Defense Department. Could you just very quickly give us a sort of status report on America's nuclear deterrent?
Well, I think the bottom line is that we've allowed it to go fallow since the end of the Cold War, and as true with a lot of our defense capabilities, we've simply not funded them and not continued the R&D that we've needed. For example, we probably no longer have the full range of nuclear deterrent capability that we had in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and 80s. You may remember the tripline doctrine in NATO Europe. And obviously, Putin, as a study of student of history, understood the very importance of having this full range of nuclear capability to apply to various stages of a conflict to make sure it didn't elevate to the next level.
So we're talking about sort of relatively low-yield tactical nuclear weapons all the way up to very devastating strategic nuclear weapons. And when you say gone fallow, could you just walk us through what that means as a practical matter? How long has it been since we've done any nuclear testing? What is the condition of the sort of intellectual personnel component of our nuclear weapons complex and the physical plant as well? It's really important to understand where we actually are, not just in the weapons themselves.
Exactly. I think the DOE weapons laboratories have essentially aged out. The guys that you and I worked with back in the 80s are now in the retired stages. I don't think there's any new blood in this business, and the technologies that we're using even out in the operational area are essentially 1970s technologies.
You know, Dan, this calls to mind an interesting anecdote from one of our old friends who shared this with me some time ago in connection with the fact that we haven't been doing any nuclear testing, no underground actual explosive nuclear testing since 1992. And he said that one of the bright young fellows who has been doing lots of simulations and modeling in the weapons complex in recent years came to him at one point and said to him, "I hate experimentation. It interferes with my calculations." And it seems to me that says volumes about the possibilities that you may be relying on simulations and modeling and so on that that doesn't actually square with reality. Could that speak to a lack of actual credible capability in our deterrent?
Well, you have to look at that as a foreign leader would look at it, as Putin would look at it, maybe the Chinese would look at it. They would have to be sitting around a table and be talking just like you and I are now, but the focus would be on the credibility of the U.S. deterrent. And there's no secrets here that it's not as credible as it used to be.
It may not be sufficiently credible is the key point. And just very quickly, Dan Gallington, I've been told that we have in this industrial plant that supports our nuclear deterrent buildings that are basically dating back to the Manhattan Project, some of them literally leaking and in otherwise terrible condition. Hard, I'm imagining, to attract good people to work in them, and really raising again the question of the degree to which foreign adversaries might think we no longer are up to deterring them.
I think that's the whole of the physical plants and the infrastructure has just, as I said, gone fallow. It really has. There's got to be a serious and long-term injection of both money and talent into this effort, or we're going to continue to slide down the line as we have.
Well, and more to the point, face actual threats, perhaps being executed against us, not just, at the rhetorical level. Dan, let me switch gears, because as you mentioned, you were the last bipartisan counsel on the Intelligence Committee in the Senate. It is a very partisan place these days. Could you just give us a quick update on the status, as best we can tell, of the investigations that the Senate panel and its House counterparts have been engaged in with respect to this whole allegation of Russian collusion in the 2016 presidential election of the United States?
Well, my assessment is that, and always has been, that it's essentially a political exercise and has been from the very first and continues to be. I wrote a piece not so long ago in the Washington Times about how these special prosecutors generally do their job, and what they generally do is to focus on the smaller players in any situation and get them in violation of some technical or regulatory set of laws, and then use that as leverage to compel them to cooperate with them against a larger target, whoever that might be. Manafort, for example, was involved in an activity that I think would be an understatement to say regulatory intensive, because he was consulting and he was in various business relationships with foreigners. Now, I won't say it's impossible to do that kind of work without doing something wrong or some technical violation, but it's very, very hard to avoid the regulatory morass, the ITARs, the regulation of foreign agencies, all that stuff. It's an incredibly complex area.
And this is Paul Manafort, the former chairman of the President's Campaign Committee, and it certainly seems there's blood in the water with respect to his prosecution.
Yeah, right. And then you have this whole set of previous statements that you made. A lot of people get themselves in trouble when they're interviewed, and instead of saying, "Well, I'm not going to talk about that, I'm going to exercise my right to counsel," they may go ahead and make a statement, and the statement turns out to be false or incorrect. Now, typically you have that dynamic going on in an investigation such as this.
And a guy like Mueller will squeeze you to get your cooperation with the prosecution of others. Dan Gallington, we are hard out of time. There's so much more to talk about. I hope you'll join us again in the near future to continue our conversation. In the meantime, thank you for the terrific contributions you've made to our country over the years, and I know you're continuing to, among other things, in your outlet at the Washington Times. We'll look forward to continuing the conversation. We'll look forward to talking to the rest of you again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.